Exodus, the Tabernacle. The 27th talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on September 3, 2017 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by David Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to David Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. Handout number 25, Exodus, the Tabernacle, accompanies this talk.
I'm returning to Exodus, where I left off. I'm going to start out with a review of what has happened up to now, and then I'm just going to give some background information about this next section, and then I'll stop there this week, and we'll start in with narrative on the tabernacle next week. So this may be shorter than usual, we'll see. Depends how loquacious I get in the middle of it. Where are we in Exodus? What's happened in Exodus up to this point? Moses was born under miraculous circumstances, that is to say, Pharaoh, who had enslaved the Israelites in Egypt, had decreed that all of the baby Hebrew boys be put to death. But Moses' parents put him in a basket and stuck the basket in the Nile. And instead of being cast into the Nile, which is what, to be killed, which is what Pharaoh had commanded, he was plucked out of the Nile by Pharaoh's daughter and was adopted into the family of Pharaoh and raised as one of Pharaoh's grandchildren. For his first 40 years of life, then, he was raised in a privileged situation in the household of the Pharaoh, and yet he knew very well that his identity was Hebrew, that he was born to Hebrew parents, and that he was one of the people that Egypt had enslaved. At 40 years, we see in the narrative that he becomes very interested in and driven to use his privileged position as one raised in the household of Pharaoh, use his position and influence to help his people who were suffering from their oppression and their slavery. And in the course of doing so, he kills an Egyptian man, an overlord, who had been abusing some of the slave workers. He thought he had done so in a way that would not be detected, but it turned out that he was wrong. The next day, he tries to break up a fight between two Hebrews, and it becomes clear that they don't want his interference in their affairs, and they know that he had killed an Egyptian slave master. And therefore, Moses knew that his life was in danger. So he fled. And as he's fleeing, it's clear that he is bitter about the fact that he had been rejected by his own people. That in his efforts to help his people, he discovered that they didn't want him meddling in their affairs. They didn't see him as being appropriate in showing any kind of leadership or authority in their midst. He takes off, he goes to Midian, and lives the life of a shepherd out in the wilderness herding flocks. And he does that for 40 years. So it's 40 years where he's growing up in privilege with lots of promise as to what he might be able to achieve in his life. And then 40 years where he is stuck out in the middle of nowhere raising sheep. And it looks like that's the way his life will end, that that will be all that, that happens in his life. But at that time then, God comes and speaks to Moses at Mount Sinai in the burning bush. God speaks to Moses and tells him that he wants Moses to go back to Egypt and lead his people out of slavery, out of Egypt. And Moses is not interested. Moses makes it really clear he doesn't want to do it. He doesn't think he's suited to do it, and he declines to do it. He gives excuses why he shouldn't provide that service three times before God convinces him to do it. But God does convince him to do it. Moses does go back, and on the way back to Egypt, there's a little incident that's very mysterious where Moses gets sick and is just about to die. And he recovers only after, if I'm understanding the passage correctly, only after his son is circumcised. And if you'll recall way back when I talked about it, which is unlikely, I think that what's happening there is Moses had reached the place where he no longer really identified with his people. And that the significance of that incident was that God was impressing upon him that he had to identify with his people. And therefore his son had to be circumcised, as was required of all of the Hebrew sons, needed to be circumcised before he could proceed. As we see in the next few weeks, I think that incident becomes more significant than I had previously realized. Moses goes back to Egypt. He appears before Pharaoh, says, "Let my people go." And Pharaoh says, "No way." And as God had said, as God has instructed Moses, there are 10 plagues then that God inflicts on the Egyptians and on Pharaoh to force Pharaoh to let the Israelites go. And so there are 10 different things that happen in Egypt that are significant events that show that God is in control, Yahweh is in control of things. Pharaoh can't compete. Pharaoh, the most powerful man in the world at the time, and one thought to be at least semi-divine, was no competition for Yahweh. The last of those plagues was that God came and killed the firstborn throughout Egypt, all their firstborn children and the animals as well. And after that plague, Pharaoh says, "Okay, you can go." And so Moses takes the people of Israel and they flee out towards the desert. God takes them in a weird route in which they backtrack a bit and it looks like they're lost. And then they get kind of pinned against the Red Sea. Pharaoh is aware of what's happening, but has a change of heart and decides, "I shouldn't have let him go." And so he sends his chariots out to get him and bring him back. So the Israelites are pinned against the water with Pharaoh's army coming. And at that very time then, God opens up the sea and the Israelites go through on dry land. And then as soon as Pharaoh's army enters into the sea behind the Israelites, the water crashes in and destroys them. After they cross the Red Sea then and have a celebration that we'll be talking about just a little bit yet today, they start their way through the wilderness in Sinai, into the Sinai desert. They go 3 days into the desert, run out of water, and complain. We would have been better off if we had stayed in Egypt. We just came out here to die. There's water there, but it's bitter water. And God commands Moses to throw wood into the water. He does so, and the water becomes good, and they are able to drink water. A little bit later, they run out of meat, and God provides meat by quail that they can just lean over and pick up, capture by hand, and cook and eat it. Later, God provides them with manna, food that comes down nightly from heaven, and they can collect it and eat it. So God is miraculously providing for them as they go through the desert. There are times when it looks dire, but God each time comes through and provides for them what they need. So they make their way down through the Sinai Desert and along a projection of water that we call the Red Sea, and then they turn inland and go up in elevation quite high up to Mount Sinai. And it's at Mount Sinai then, the place where God had appeared to Moses in the burning bush, that same place, that's where they go back to. And at that place then, God appears to them. God doesn't allow any of them to come up onto the mountain. The mountain is a holy place. God will eventually meet with Moses alone on the top of that mountain. No one else is allowed to come up onto the heights of the mountain. But God is there. His presence is indicated by a number of natural phenomena. There's an earthquake, there's smoke, there's lightning, there's quite a shock and awe kind of presence that God manifests on the mountain. And God says that he tells Moses, I am going to make you, that is, you the Israelites, I am going to make you my people, and I will be your God. And you will be a nation of priests to me. That's what God offers to do, to have a special relationship with the children of Israel. And all that God's requiring is that they be obedient to him, that they follow his commandments. So the people they like that arrangement. That's a great arrangement. They say, yes, let's do it. So God tells them what it is that he requires, and he speaks to them directly and gives them the Ten Commandments with his own voice. He lists the Ten Commandments, at the conclusion of which the people are so frightened that they say, let's not do this. This is too scary. Why don't you tell Moses what you want us to hear, and he can tell us what that is, rather than you speaking to us directly? That's a bit intimidating. So that is indeed what happens after the Ten Commandments. Then Moses is instructed more fully in the laws the people of Israel are to follow. All of that then is reported to the people, and they are agreeable to this arrangement, that they are willing to follow those commandments, and they want God to be their God. They want Yahweh to be their God. And so at the conclusion of this, they have a ceremony in which bulls are sacrificed and the blood is sprinkled on the people, and they eat a meal, and the elders go a little ways up on the mountain where they eat the meal, and in God's presence. So it's as if they are eating a meal with God, and that will become significant later on. When they're done then eating the meal, and the covenant then is sealed between God and his people, then Moses goes to the top of the mountain, and he spends 6 days waiting, and then on the seventh day, God appears, speaks to him, and Moses ends up being on that mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. While he's on that mountain for the 40 days and 40 nights, God is giving him instructions with respect to the construction of a tent that God wants the Israelites to build. And that's the tabernacle. The tabernacle, talk about the tabernacle then, is going to dominate the rest of the book of Exodus. We have 16 chapters yet to go. And all but three of those chapters are talking about the tabernacle. We're going to have seven chapters where God gives instructions as to how this thing is supposed to be constructed. Then we have three chapters in which there's the incident with the golden calf, which I found fascinating looking at it this time. It's much more significant than I had previously thought. So that comes in the middle. And then we have the rest of the chapters, six chapters, where it talks about the temple or the tabernacle actually being constructed. I think it highly likely that this portion of Exodus is rarely taught in churches. Every commentary that I read talks about how tedious it is and how mind-numbing it is. And when I taught Exodus a number of years ago, I skipped this section. I just taught the historical narrative and skipped this section because I didn't know what to do with it. One of the reasons that I wanted to reteach Exodus is because I wanted to revisit this section and try to figure out what's going on here. But it is difficult and it is rather challenging to figure out what is going on and then how to talk about it. One of the authors that I read is Joshua Berman, who wrote a book on the temple, but he talks quite a bit about the tabernacle. And he says, these passages often seem dry, detailed, and uninspiring, and that's true. But I really do think that it's important to go through these and understand what is in these in the context of the whole book of Exodus. Part of the reason that I wanted to work through Exodus is because there has been a change in my thinking in the last few years in that I have become more appreciative of the Old Testament background to the New Testament message. That there is background, there is cultural knowledge, there is vocabulary that was built into Jewish culture at the time in which the New Testament was written, and that I think that the New Testament authors were drawing on heavily when they wrote the New Testament. And that those things, that is, that cultural background, is important to understand because it provides the vocabulary for understanding the New Testament message. It's got to be there for a reason. And that includes the laws, which I have not taken as seriously as I need to. It includes the sacrificial system, which I have ignored completely up to now. It includes the religious ritual, including the tabernacle and the temple, which are just brimming with symbolism. And that's got to be of some significance. And is that it is critical to understand all of that stuff so that it can bring to life then the things that we read in the New Testament and the things in particular that Jesus says and does during his lifetime. So that's why I want to spend some time on this. I think it is important to see this in the context of Exodus. Exodus is a literary unit, and these are serving some literary purpose in the story that's being told in the book of Exodus. And the question, what is that purpose and how does it fit in? Why is it here at all? This is about one-third of the book of Exodus. And generally speaking, the amount of text that is devoted to a topic is somewhat proportional to its importance. And I think, therefore, that the tabernacle and the temple are frequently alluded to in the New Testament, the Old Testament, and I think have an importance that I have not heretofore really appreciated. Why is the tabernacle important? I think that we have, in the early history of Israel, and particularly in the Pentateuch, I think that God has set out to establish a cultural vocabulary that is helpful for understanding concepts that he wants to develop and present later. He's going to establish a cultural vocabulary, so sacrifices, the temple, and those come to have a particular meaning and an association of ideas with them. And God is going to develop that and, in a sense, bring out abstractions out of that as time goes on. I've used this analogy before, but I think it's a lot like manipulatives in math. When you're teaching a young child math, it helps to have those little blocks out on the table so that you can show them the concepts of addition and subtraction and multiplication and division, and they can actually see it. Later on, you can talk about those concepts without the blocks being out there on the table. You can abstract those concepts out and talk about them in an even more sophisticated way. But to understand the basic concept, it helps to have those manipulatives out there. And I think that God has done the same thing with the religious trappings, the religion that God gave to the Israelites. The symbolism is all serving that same purpose. It's like the manipulatives that we need in order to understand the concepts. In particular, the concept that gets pounded in with respect to the tabernacle is holiness. What is holiness? And there are all kinds of things that are said and built into the symbolism of the tabernacle that indicate a separation between the mundane and the profane and that which is holy. And the temple, the tabernacle, does that. There's a separation that is created and that is important to God. The tabernacle, and so holiness is one of God's distinctives, if not his most important distinctive. And that's one of the concepts that can be visualized with the help of the tabernacle. And as we will see, the tabernacle ends up being a picture of God's, not just his holiness, but also his immanence and his transcendence at the same time. That God is both transcendent, that is, he's the creator and he is the ruler over all of us. He's on a different plane of existence from us. But he is also right here with us. He is also immanent. And how do you fit that together in the tabernacle, I think, is a way that can help us to understand that. Now, the tabernacle, I'm convinced, is just packed full of symbolism. There are lots of details that are given to us about how it is to be constructed, what are the materials, how are they put together, how are they organized, what are the restrictions, et cetera, et cetera. It has to be just packed with symbolism. The question is, how do you figure that stuff all out and make sense of it? And my thinking is that in order to understand the symbols that are being presented to us, we first have to be able to visualize ourselves in that setting. So filling that out and understanding what it was like, how it worked as best we can, that will help us then to figure out what symbols are present and what they indicate. So that's what I'm hoping to do, is to help you as well as possible to imagine what this thing was. I don't know the answer to what these things symbolize. There are a few things that suggestions that I can make, but I'm not even pretending that I know all of the symbolism involved in the tabernacle. As a result, my presentations will just be a primer, but I hope that it will be a helpful start. It'll be a helpful primer. Okay, so today what I would like to do, just three things that I want to accomplish. One is to talk about the ancient Near Eastern precedents for this tabernacle. The second is to talk about some of the basic principles of holy places in the ancient world. And the third is I want to give you my first shot to answering the question, what was the purpose of the tabernacle? Okay, ancient Near Eastern precedents. I will point out that I have been surprised going through Exodus this time, seeing the extent to which the things in Exodus that God gave to the Israelites, the law, and now the tabernacle, and some of the religious requirements, how many of those have close parallels in the ancient Near Eastern world? These things were not new. God didn't come up with these things as complete innovations. Rather, what God seems to be doing is drawing upon the cultural vocabulary of the ancient Near Eastern world and using it for his purposes. So he takes things pretty much wholesale as they were in other countries, but tweaks them a little bit and gives them a little different significance. And the end result is quite a different story, but he's using the vocabulary that's already existent. The tabernacle is no exception to that. There were precedents for this kind of thing. I was absolutely unaware that most of the cultures of the ancient Near East had portable shrines that they would take with them. Almost always, they would take them on military expeditions. And sometimes they were pulled by animals, sometimes they were carried by people, but they were portable. Sometimes they were tents that had to be set up, and sometimes they was all self-contained in a little tiny home type thing. In these shrines, typically they would have an idol to their god, who would be sitting oftentimes on the throne inside the shrine. They would take that with them. It would be in their camps with them. And whenever they had to make any major decisions, it was commonplace in the ancient world for them to get omens from their god before they would make a decision as to what they would do. And they would do that, they would do their divination right in front of this shrine. The shrines, these little portable shrines, were extremely common in Canaan. Quite interestingly. And in Canaan in particular, they were typically covered with either red skins or red fabric. And as we will see, the tabernacle is also on the outside is covered with red. So this is a common kind of phenomenon in the ancient Near East. But the closest parallel to the tabernacle was the tent of Ramses II of Egypt, the Pharaoh of Egypt. Now, as I talked about long, long ago, there are a couple of ways of calculating the date of the Exodus. One would be to take the numbers that we find in the Old Testament at face value, that is literally. And if we do that, the Exodus turns out to be in the 1400s BC. But the archaeological evidence seems to fit an Exodus in the 1200s sometime, B.C., at about the time of Ramses II. And There are some who take one number in the Old Testament to have symbolic value rather than to be literal. And if you take it to be have symbolic value, then it could accommodate then a date of the Exodus in the 1200s. If the Exodus occurred in the 1200s, then it corresponds with the time of Ramses II. Ramses II had a special tent that he would use when his army would go on expedition. And that tent would be packed up when they were moving, and then when they would stop and encamp, that tent would be set up. That tent has the same proportions to the dimensions that the tabernacle has. And we have a drawing of a map showing Ramses' tent in an Egyptian encampment. And in the ancient world, in most countries, the encampments were an oval shape, and the shrine would be located someplace in that oval shape, and I'm not sure where. In some cases, the shrine was actually located outside of the camp. In the case of Ramses II, his tent was located right in the middle of not an oval shape, but of a rectangle. And we know that the Israelites encamped in a rectangle. In this tent, then, there is an entry room in Ramses II's tent, an entry room. And then there's a small room at the back, which was his throne room. His throne was set up there. And if people, officers were to come with to him with concerns, things that needed to be ruled upon, judged upon, they would approach him on his throne in his tent. So there are several commentators that have made the observation that precedent is the one that seems to be the closest match to the tabernacle, that is, the tent of Ramses II, on his throne, traveling with his troops. Joshua Bergman has wrote an article in which he argues that the Exodus was a historic event. And he makes an interesting argument, and I will just briefly go through a little bit of what he talks about there, but I have the link in the notes, and you can look at that. You can go and read the article if you're interested. I thought it was quite interesting. Ramses II went on an expedition into Canaan and had a remarkable victory against one of the armies when they were in the land of Canaan, in which the Egyptians, it looked like, were losing this battle, and it was an important battle for the Egyptians. It looked like they were losing, and Ramses decided that he was going to take an active part in the combat, and he went out and single-handedly led the troops against the Canaanites and turned the battle around and drove the Canaanites into a river, in which they went into the river, and then the Egyptians killed them. And in celebrating this victory, there was a very lengthy poem that was written describing this victory. And there have been several copies of this poem that have been found by archaeologists. And Berman points out that there are a number of similarities between that poem and the poem that occurs in Exodus 15, right after the Egyptian army is swamped in the Red Sea. There are similarities in language, where he says it describes the enemies of Pharaoh as chaff, which is the word that's used in Exodus 15:7 in referring to the Egyptians. In the poem about Pharaoh, he's quasi-divine, and he's the one who leads the rout against the enemy. In Exodus 14:14, it says that God defeated the Egyptians single-handedly. When the enemy was fleeing ahead of the Egyptians, they cried out, saying that Pharaoh was being aided by a goddess. And so they had to get out of there. And in Exodus 14:25, the Egyptians said, "Let us flee from the Israelites, for the Lord," for Yahweh, "is fighting for them against Egypt." And he lists some other things. Oh, another one is the "with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm." That phrase is used in the poem about Pharaoh's victories. Well, that same phrase is used with respect to God in defeating the Egyptians. Berman says, "Consider the familiar biblical refrain that God took Israel out of Egypt, quote, with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. The Bible could have employed that phrase to describe a whole host of divine acts on Israel's behalf. And yet the phrase is used only with reference to the Exodus. This is no accident. In much of Egyptian royal literature, the phrase mighty hand is a synonym for the Pharaoh. And many of the Pharaoh's actions are said to be performed through his mighty hand or his outstretched arm. Nowhere else in the ancient Near East are rulers described in this way." So if that article sounds interesting, I would encourage you to read it. His basic point is, well, the description that we have in Exodus, drawing upon all of these allusions to Egyptian terminology and events, would only have been known in ancient times. And therefore, Exodus must represent an ancient tradition rather than a more modern composition that some scholars have argued that it is. If he's right, then the tabernacle is a borrowed image that, just as Pharaoh, a quasi-divine king, was traveling with his troops, was available to his troops, was there to help them with their needs as they arose, was intimately familiar with all of the problems that they were facing. Similarly, God was encamped, Yahweh was encamped with his people as they are marching out on their own military expedition. Okay. Sarna points out that this section of Exodus fits into a genre that is well represented in the ancient Near Eastern world, that is, of these accounts of temples being built, that they typically talk about instructions as to what is to be done in order to have this thing built, and then description of those things being carried out. So this fits into that literary pattern. The basic principles of the tabernacle. Now, the tabernacle is a tent. It's a tent that the Israelites will carry with them as they march through the wilderness and as they go into Israel. But the tabernacle then is going to be replicated in a bigger, more permanent structure, and that is the temple. Solomon will eventually have a temple built which has a number of the features that are in the tabernacle. So the tabernacle is a precursor then to the temple, and we don't have a lot of these shrines. We have some drawings of them, but we don't have archaeological remains of the shrines, but we do have archaeological remains of temples in the ancient Near East. And from those, it is possible to determine some of the principles on which these temples are built. What do they signify, and what's going on in these temples? Throughout the ancient Near Eastern world, these temples always face east. So the doorway is to the east. They contain concentric circles, that is, concentric circles of holiness. You have the inside circle, which is the most holy. Then outside of that, you have one that is less holy. And outside of that, you have one that is even less holy. So as you go in, it gets more holy. And the holiness is accompanied by restrictions. The greater the restrictions, the more the holiness. Each of these circles then has its own set of symbols, its own set of rituals, its own set of materials. So the outer circle has certain kinds of materials, certain kinds of rituals take place there. The next circle in has a different set of rituals that take place, a different set of materials, and the inner circle that's also true. The temples are all apparently based on a house. They are patterned after a house of the culture in which these temples are built. And in the ancient world, the house was a sanctuary for the owner. And it was an understood cultural concept that to gain entrance into the house, you have to have permission from the owner. And to move further into the house, you have to have permission from the owner. And the further you are allowed to go into the house, the greater your degree of friendship with the owner. So only the owner's very best friends would be allowed into the innermost sanctuary in the house. There is furniture in the temples that match the furniture in houses. That is to say, when you first come in, the furniture is typically furniture that's appropriate for eating a meal. As you go in further, it's the innermost room is where the master sleeps and rests. And so furniture that's appropriate for that purpose. The temples then retain these features that the restrictions get greater as you move towards the most important part of the house. And there's furniture in these temples that is appropriate for the uses in the rooms in the different parts of the temple. So the temple then is God's house. It has everything that he needs to live comfortably. The most private part of the house is that which is most distant from the entrance. And that's typically in the temples where the idol is located. In some cultures, the most private room in the temple was one that you had to go through the most rooms to get to. In other cultures, it was just the most distant from the front door. And in Canaan, that seemed to be the pattern. It's just it's straight back, but it's just the most distant from the front door. And that's the pattern of the tabernacle. In the temples, different people meet restrictions at different places. That is, they can only go so far. And I've listed here in the notes, this is with respect to the temple in Jerusalem. But Gentiles can only come to an area that is around the temple. They can't even approach the temple building proper. They can come onto the Temple Mount, but they can't come onto the platform on which the temple proper is located. Women can. They can go further. They can even go into the courtyard in front of the temple, but they can't go into the temple proper. Males who are not priests can even go further, but only into the area where the sacrifices were offered. Priests could go into the building proper, but only into the holy place. And then the Holy of Holies was only accessible to the high priest and that only on one day per year. So you see the restrictions get tighter and tighter as you get in to the holier place. There are things within the temple, temple building itself, that suggests that that this is where God is provided with meals. That's the imagery that's being used, and that's where the priests serve God. In the pagan temples, priests do the serving of the God there. They lay out plates of food for God and that sort of thing. In the temple in Jerusalem, they don't. It's not quite that way, but there is some symbolism of meals being eaten. The tabernacle does place an emphasis on eating of a meal, and that seems to be as a reaffirmation of friendship, because eating a meal with someone is showing a degree of intimacy, a friendship relationship, and that symbolism seems to be retained in the tabernacle and in the temple. Interestingly and significantly for us, we live in a time when we think of churches and religious buildings as being places where people gather and even participating. But that's not the way they thought about the ancient temples, and that's not the way they thought about the tabernacle. There are rituals that are occurring there. Sometimes people play a role in that, and sometimes they don't. Oftentimes they don't. That's just where it's happening. Everyone knows that it's happening. It's important that happen. But the people are not participants, for the most part, nor are they even spectators, for the most part. Only the priests are participants and spectators to them, some of them. Okay, the materials. The more precious the material, the more holy. So there is, in the Holy of Holies, that's where there's the most gold. The gold predominates. In the holy place, you'll see more silver being used. There's still some gold, but you'll see some silver used. As you move outside of that into the courtyard surrounding it, there's very little gold. And there's very little silver. There, predominantly, you see bronze. They wove fabric using three different methods. The Hoshev method of weaving, style of weaving, has the most ornate designs, and usually it includes images of cherubim. Those only are used in the Holy of Holies. Another style of weaving was the rakem. It is ornate, but there are no figures. It's all abstract designs. The third style of weaving is oreg. There are no figures. It's not ornate. It's just plain. And that's what's used to surround the tabernacle on the outside, the courtyard. The fabric that's used in the Holy of Holies and in the priest, the clothing of the high priest, there is wool and linen, and then gold is also woven into that. So the high priest's robe had to have been very heavy. And he only wore that when he went in to the Holy of Holies. He may have worn it when he went into the holy place. I can't remember. Something that's really curious here that I will just mention, and I don't know what to make of it, is there's a commandment that the Israelites are not to wear clothing made of mixed wool and linen. The high priest and the priests, however, their clothing is made of a mixture of wool and linen. And the third down is linen, it's white linen that's used around the courtyard. The colors, blue seems to be the most holy, purple comes next, and red is the most profane of those. the purity of material is significant, and the text points out that in the Holy of Holies, you don't just use gold, but you use fine gold. The incense that is burned in the Holy of Holies, or just outside the Holy of Holies on the incense stand, has to be pure frankincense. And those words are used, so it's clear that that's significant. The furniture that we find in the tabernacle, and we'll talk about all this stuff as we go through it in the next couple weeks. There's the Ark of the Covenant, which is in the Holy of Holies. That must symbolize the throne of Yahweh and his footstool. The throne is between the cherubim, the Ark of the Covenant. The box is the footstool. The table outside is for the showbread, a meal kind of piece of furniture. There's a lamp in there for light, and there's also the altar of incense, which produces a cloud. And there was a cloud on Mount Sinai when God made his presence there. Okay, so we will be going through all this stuff as it appears in the text. My plan is to do the next 7 chapters in 2 weeks. So we'll be going through quickly. There's a lot of detail, and we'll try to put it together in the most comprehensible way that I can and make it clear what's going on there as best I can, quickly. Okay, so what was the tabernacle all about? I think that Sarna is right. Sarna says in Exploring Exodus, he says, the erection of the tabernacle was a logical development. Through its instrumentality, the experience with the divine presence that occurred at Sinai could be extended as a living reality. In other words, at Sinai, they had experienced God directly. He spoke to them. And he was there on the mountain. The question was, now as they move on, what happens to God? Where does he go? And the tabernacle was a solution to that problem. God's going to go with them. He's going to be in the tent. The tabernacle will symbolize God's presence with them, just like he had been present on the mountain. So God could travel with them in a portable dwelling. God could eat a meal with the people and maintain a close relationship with them. The tabernacle was a way God could be with Israel, right in their midst. And as we'll see when we get to the incident with the golden calf, in their minds, and certainly in Moses' mind, there is a huge difference between God guiding them and God being with them. We'll see that Moses is not happy settling for God providing them guidance. Moses wants a relationship with God where God is right there with them. Emmanuel, God with us. God will be there experiencing what they experience, accessible to them so that they can bring their concerns to him, and he's right there in the midst of them. And the tabernacle, I think, is designed to communicate that he's there with them, just like he had been on Mount Sinai. I have been puzzling over this section of Exodus for several months now. I've spent a lot of time working on it and thinking about it, and it's been difficult. And the incident of the golden calf is, I just found that astounding. It's a very interesting story, much more than I had ever realized before. But it's absolutely critical for understanding what's going on in this last section of Exodus. I have concluded that what the rest of Exodus is about is how can a holy and transcendent God be with a rebellious and sinful people? How can that be? It is the recipe for disaster, because the people are going to rebel, and God, being a holy and righteous God, cannot tolerate rebellion. So the obvious result is going to be the annihilation of the people. How do we solve that problem? And I think that that's what the end of Exodus is all about. And the solution that is going to be arrived at has two different parts. One is the tabernacle, and the tabernacle is an arrangement whereby God can be in their midst, and yet there is a buffer that exists between God and the people. There are these concentric circles of reduced holiness that makes it possible for God to be in their midst and be holy and yet live right in the middle of a rebellious and sinful people, an unholy people. The other is the emergence and importance of a mediator. Moses is going to end up being the mediator, that the people are not going to deal directly with God. God is going to deal with the people via Moses and give him one degree of separation between him and the people. And it's a combination of those two things that's going to make it possible for a holy God to be in the midst of a sinful people. And one of the things that struck me as I was going through this is, if you're looking for it, this is an amazing story of the graciousness of God. The degree to which he is willing to go out of his way and work to find a solution for him to be the God of the people of Israel and for them to be his people. And that's what he's working out. Okay, that's all I had to say today. Questions or comments?
Regarding some of the things, notably how there were different precious metals in the temple, like gold for the most holy, mm-hmm. and silver and bronze for the less holy, that does kind of strike an interesting note, particularly how when the wise men, magi, brought the gifts to Jesus, that gold was the precious metal of choice.
Right. And frankincense was the incense of choice.
Yeah, and also going to another New Testament passage, I think this one is in Revelation 11, mm-hmm. was when John is instructed not to count the outer court. Is that as well the Gentiles are? Is that the same thing, only dealing with levels of holiness in the temple?
I don't remember Revelation 11, so what are you likening to it?
What it is John is given a scroll, and is given a reed like a measuring rod. He says, but exclude the outer court. Do not measure it, because it has been given to the Gentiles.
Okay.
Yeah, I was wondering if
that's related.
Yes.
I don't know.
Yeah, to the whole thing of how the high priest only has access to the Holy of Holies, the high priest, the outreaches of the temple, men, the temple, women, the outer temple, and the Gentiles, the very outer court.
Mm-hmm. I'm confident that knowing about the temple is helpful for understanding Revelation 11, but exactly what's going on in Revelation 11, I don't know. Hopefully I'll know within the year.
Well, I look forward to seeing where we're going with this and God's mercy. I wanted to just back up to kind of early history. You know, as Christians in Sunday school, you know, everything kind of centers on the story of Israel. And it wasn't until I started studying some world history that you realized all these different cultures developing at the same time. And as you related the Israelites to cultures around them, and thinking of God as sovereign and the one kind of writing the whole story, it's just kind of interesting that even though he didn't make himself known to earlier cultures, he was very much involved in how they developed, and somehow when he pulled Israel out of it, it just seems like, it's just interesting hearing your comments. I just wondered if you could say something about his work in earlier cultures and how Israel is kind of, how he pulls them out as a separate unit that know him, rather than having Ramses in the center of this building.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that I think it has to be the case that God is working through these other cultures to produce the cultural vocabulary that he wants to draw upon in order to tell the story that he wants to tell with the nation of Israel. And I'm confident that God was working even in the lives of individuals before we get to Abraham. I mean, we get a sense of that from the Old Testament, but even in other lines and in places that aren't talked about by the Bible at all, I'm sure that God is active doing his thing in individual lives. But he's creating this incredible story that weaves together the experience of these people all over the world in every age. It's a very complex story that he's telling, but it's all purposeful. It's all going to make sense in the end. How good a sense we're going to be able to make of it, I don't know. But it's all going to make sense in the end, and it's going to be a truly grand story. The first archaeologists, having been brought up studying the Bible, they expected to find David's palace, and it would be the biggest, grandest palace ever, anywhere. And they did that with everything. They thought it will be the biggest and grandest. And when they started digging, the results were not what they expected. Israel was not by far the greatest kingdom in the ancient world. That's what they had expected. But they had gotten that perspective because they had been reading the Bible and they saw all of these people in bigger and bigger than life kind of form. And that was a little misleading. God is more mundane than that. Israel was more ordinary than that. In fact, Israel was kind of a small country. Its success was largely due to the fact that it was strong when all of the surrounding countries were weak. So it became prominent because of the weakness in the world at the time rather than its strength. But all of that was orchestrated by God. And God was using a rather insignificant nation to accomplish what are truly amazing things. And that's what we see working out in history. So it's a little different picture than certainly they had and certain than we might get. God is much more busy in the ordinary than we give him credit. He's accomplishing more there. Okay.